It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona, in the studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com, where we're always doing something. There's a lot of something going on. You know, I'm right now, they're doing some electrical stuff for a piece of equipment and getting that done. We're getting our folder. We got that refurbed yesterday. Do a lot of folding. We're getting the blades sharpened on our paper cutters. And that's, you know, these are like 3 foot long blades, you know, and they're sharp and you got to, oh. Lots of hassle because you got to build a wood jig or they won't even take them to sharpen them. And so we're in the middle of that. Why? Because we might have an impact on the election process in 2010. A lot of people don't understand, you know, why it is that we do things the way that we do. I'll give you an example. We'll have a gentleman, he's endorsed by Dr. Paul. His name is Brian Miller in Congressional 8 in the Tucson southeastern part of the state. It goes from southeastern Arizona, the border with New Mexico and Mexico, and goes up to Tucson to incorporate, you know, some of the population there. They got enough people, you know. So we have a Republican that's running against, you know, the evil Democrat. And you got some other evil Republicans that are doing the same thing. And he's the one that's endorsed by Dr. Paul. Well, there's some activists that, you know, I go, yeah, sure. You know, individuals can come up and do whatever they want. If you got volunteers that, you know, want to come all the way up to Phoenix and make use of whatever, we can show them how we do stuff. And they go down there and they can whip butt and everything. So that might happen. You know, there's been a couple guys come up, took a look at what we do and how, and then they'll take that knowledge and do whatever if they are so motivated. Well, what is it that we're wanting to do? We want to go help candidates. We want to get them all set up so they can get their message of we're not as bad as the other guy. I mean, what is it that we want to accomplish? Individuals can do whatever they want. You know, this is the one thing that I want to make sure that individuals get to do what they want. The thing is that what do I want to do? Well, the big thing is giving people the ability to do what they want to do. Because if it's not their idea, you're not going to get, you know, that much work out of them. I mean, unless you're paying them or something. But if somebody's got an idea, is passion, that rather than watching primetime television, they would be down doing something because that's what they want to do. Nobody ever does it what somebody else wants to do. It's always, how can I get them to do what I want them to do? You know, and I don't operate that way because it doesn't work because nobody's going to get me to do what they want me to do. They're going to have to convince me that it's something that I want to do. So I try and make it as fun as possible and that we have a common goal, something that we can overlap on and what we want to do. Here in Arizona, we have election cycle that generally, over the years, I've been doing this since 1990. This is over 20 years of this. And I probably more than most, you know, myself, my wife, some of my friends, know the impact, the cultural change, the shift in the paradigm here in Arizona from our efforts over 20 years. We got another election cycle coming up. What are we going to do? What's our goal? What are we going to change? How are we going to do it? And how are we going to be absolutely certain before we even start that we already won? We'll talk about it when we come back.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Oh, yeah. Your smile speaks books to me. Break up with each and every one of your looks. And you're starting something deep inside of me. And you're sparking something this far from me. I'm out of control. I want to rush headlong into this ecstasy. If I could only reach you, if I could make you smile.
If I could only make you smile, maybe you'll pay attention for just a little bit longer. Maybe you'll, you know, hey, those looks like those guys are having fun. Hey, I want to go have some fun, too. I'm sitting here yelling at the TV. I'm sitting here, you know, yelling at the bubble-headed bleach blondes, you know, coming on at 5 and tell me about a plane crash with a gleam in their eye. I'd rather do something. And what might that be? Go hang with people that, you know, are pleasant. They're enjoying themselves. You know, get to know people and spend some time with people that, you know, kind of, you know, if not think like I do, allow me to think. See, that's the difference. That's one thing that's kind of cool. There are many different activities that go on around here and other people that kind of branch out from here. We have there's a progressive group that meets at no gentleman's house about 2-3 times a year. They'll have a big party or barbecue or something whenever we're around. You know, I'll go, and a lot of the other guys go, and then they come here for movie night on Saturday nights, and they do a lot of stuff and everything. But the one thing that would shock people is how different they are. I'll give you an example. Saturday morning we had the Arizona Breakfast Club, and we did a presentation Powell Gammel did on Afghan war. You know, we've been in Afghanistan longer than we were in Vietnam. I mean, we had to mark that occasion. And it was interesting that there was one older gentleman that had gone to the Breakfast Club years ago, you know, probably 10, 15 years ago in the mid-90s, back when Harry Everingham was doing everything. And he was upset. What? This seems like this is a libertarian meeting. No, you guys, you're not towing the Republican line, man. Hey, what up? And he was really in support of Israel. And I mean, you know, it was all the bullet points of, you know, his generation. So we took the opportunity to educate him. I mean, he came, you know, cool. He'll probably come back. We had conversation after and so on. But we had to go through the history of the Breakfast Club and who ran it and why and how and what the makeup is now and so on. And I'll share that with you because it is a very interesting and informative walk through history. And I'll give it to you from my perspective. And then, of course, the best I can do on the other guys. In 1990, early 90s or something, I was doing my challenge in the state. I mean, it wasn't a secret. I wasn't in any group or anything. I just knew we were, man, what the heck. And it was a realization of just how bad the government was and everything. I mean, it's a long story, but we got time. We're going to do it today. Here we go. I'm going to tell you, you guys are going to get what for. And how I dovetailed into the Arizona Breakfast Club, and now I do that. But I didn't make it any kind of a collective. They used to have a board of directors, you know, a post office box, an office. I'm going, oh, heck no. We're not going to have any structure. You know, I mean, I'll get guests and subjects, and we'll do a web page, and I'll kind of make sure everybody knows where we're gathering. And whoever wants to do anything, you'd speak up. You know, whoever wants to take the money or be in charge of passing a hat or getting material, whatever. Frank, you want to do it? All right, cool, man. He's a, you know, responsible guy, got taken care of. You know, I'll if I'm not going to be there, make sure somebody else is running the meeting, or you guys can do it, or I'm whatever. You know, we're gonna learn stuff. We're gonna keep doing what the tradition of the Breakfast Club was, because it was this. During World War II, there was a role that was played by United We Stand at the time. We the People was a group that was done by a gentleman named Harry Everingham. Harry died a few years ago at 94, I think, 92. And he was, you know, an amazing individual. And when he passed away, I inherited 2 4-stack filing cabinets, these tall filing cabinets that are, you know, 4 drawers high. And it was just full of all the people that he'd been in contact with over the years since the 50s or sometimes even earlier. There were personal autographed letters, private notes, and pictures from Ronald Reagan to him. I have a friend of mine that is just a big Ronald Reagan fan. So I took PDF, I mean, scanned them in the PDF so everybody knew that, you know, here we have them and you got it on file somewhere and, you know, so it won't evaporate and so on, everybody can see it. I mean, but actually touchy-feely it, you know, who cares? You know, but a lot of people do. I mean, I just wanted, you know, it was interesting history of what he had to say and so on. And then I gave it to my friend that's a big, giant Ronald Reagan guy. And I liked it. I would have kept it. But, I get a picture of it and so on. I was good enough. I'm good. But, you know, he really appreciated that. So there's a lot of stuff like that, you know, from William Buckley Jr., from Pat Buchanan. He really traveled in these conservative Goldwater-type Republican crowds. Now, I'll give you the history on it. This is a very good lineage, a connection that you can see to how we get from a God-fearing country, family, pillar of community, Republican, the old school from the 50s, challenged a communist, a communist, a communist. All of a sudden you wind up, it's 2010, and that same organization, there's a bunch of libertarians there. How the heck did that happen? I'm going to walk you through it. During World War II, there was a role for people that went around encouraging, motivating people to amp up for the war effort, to instill in them a nationalism, a patriotism, that them making C rations, them, you know, Rosie the Riveter making airplane parts, to, you know, all these people that were working, the women, even the children, Liberty Gardens, all this kind of stuff, that there was a need for someone to take advantage of and fan the flames of nationalism. That's exactly what was going on in Mother Russia and Nazi Germany. And it was all about, you know, us versus them. And, you know, don't you, you know, get that feeling of pride and pomp and circumstance and colors and flags and all that kind of stuff. America's more individualistic. There's all kinds of weird things that, you know, play into war that they didn't anticipate. Like a lot of the infantry soldiers did not fire their weapons. I mean, when you get a German, you're within 100 yards or something, you got a guy right there, you got him in your sights, like I just pull the trigger, guy dead, and a lot of them couldn't do it. A lot of books written on that, why they had to, you know, change their training and so on to get them into this, you know, Marine kill, 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 kill every time they thrust their bayonet kind of thing. So there was a lot of this stuff. The Americans were not, our culture was not towards war like other European monarchies and so on were. They were, you know, you weren't a man until you lost a limb, you know, in service of the empire or something. So they reinforced this kind of stuff where America was not that way. I mean, we were farmers, more rural types. We were just, you know, want to be left alone. And the federal government, what? You know, they're who? I mean, you know, they didn't understand what was happening to them in the Great Depression. Banking, they weren't sophisticated enough to really know what was going on and why their wealth had been taken away and why they're taking away their gold and why. I mean, they just didn't know. At the time, there were writers like H.L. Mencken. You know, a lot of a contemporary guy, his name is Vince Aprenowitz. He's one of the editors at the Las Vegas Review Journal, a large newspaper in Nevada. And it's just, I love his writing. And they remind me of each other, kind of how they call BS on the whole system. Well, what happened was these writers and these economists, the Austrian economists, you know, the Hayeks and the Hazlitts and a lot of these guys you probably never heard of, Mises and Rothbard and on and on and on and on, you know, Friedman's and so on. All these guys, they understood what was happening. They understood. And it's taken generations. It's taken a 73-year-old man, congressman from Texas, to keep screaming every time he went on Jay Leno, every time he's on the news, every time he kept saying Austrian economics. Well, it's not like it's practiced in Austria. They call it Austrian economics because it was Austrians, Austrian, you know, Mises and these guys, they were Austrian. So they just call it Austrian economics. It has nothing to do with Austria. It's just, you know, what they call it. So it's free market capitalism, what it is. So it's just free market everything. So economics also transcends into social dealings. Because you're always dealing in trade with negotiating with something. I mean, even if you're not doing cash, you're coming into some kind of an agreement. I'm going to do this because I want to, and you don't mind. Okay, well, it's all good. I'm doing it. I mean, you know, it's a free market kind of thing. When we come back, I'll go ahead and start from that. You needed that base understanding that this has been going on for a long time. And the story of Harry Everingham should be told. I mean, you know, I found out a lot more as time would go on in the 15 years I knew him. And it's an interesting story. You stay right there. You're going to enjoy this. People everywhere just
want to be free. And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Just running against the wind, you know, but you know, sometimes you get a brisker, more alive, waking feeling when you got the wind blowing in your face. You tilt your head back, let the wind blow through the hair. Oh man, that's on the front of the bow of the ship. I'm king of the world. Well, there's a lot of people that they really, really, really did want to be king of the world, and there were people that were trying to stop them. There were people that just wanted to, you know, free the minds of other people. There is, I'm going to go ahead and give you the connections here between Harry Everingham and the libertarian movement. And way before there was a Libertarian Party, you know, there was a book written back, I mean, an article written back in 1967. And it was The Farther Shores of Politics, the American Political Fringe Today by George Thayer, which was Simon & Schuster. Yeah, in New York in 1967. I was doing some research for some writings I was doing years ago. I had when I had my restaurant one summer, I was out motorcycle riding with my boys, and I broke my left collarbone really bad. I mean, I crushed it. It was amazing. I mean, dang. But you know, so I'm not really able to do anything for a couple of months, and I took advantage. And man, you are not allowed to be a slacker when you got a restaurant, and if you got your wife and kids, you know, kind of picking up the slack and assistant managers, all that kind of stuff. You better be doing something. I mean, you're weeding the garden. You're doing something. So what I decided to do during that time with, you know, I had my left arm where I could kind of reach a keyboard and the right. I go, now's a good time. Well, I got a couple of months. I will go ahead and just all of the activities that I have done before. I mean, it's not really a book. It's just more like notes. You know, it's just like before I forgot it all. And I this was done in, oh, like 2002, one, something like that. And I go, I think it was before 9/11. Probably was. So I go ahead and I did it all the way up to 1998. From 88 to 98, I went in. I'm due to do it again, I'm sure. But I took all the stuff that I remembered, all the things that we had done, which were a lot, all the campaigns, so that you could understand, so that I could remember how it was that we got to where we were. What was the connection? What was the thread? You know, I remember a show on PBS, they called it Connections. It was a fascinating show. And it would be, you look at a computer and you go, okay, how do we get a computer? And they go back to, you know, monks doing tapestries back before and how they did the the threads to go. And then they put information on punch cards that they made out of wood, and all of a sudden, boom, you got a computer. There's always a beginning. And with the accumulation of knowledge, it happens much faster. The internet is not so it doesn't make it happen. It allows it to happen. You have all this accumulation of knowledge. You'll go, you know, centuries, you'll go millennia before you'll have a tribe of human beings be able to, you know, share with the next person with their cave dwelling painting on the wall kind of stuff that they go, hey, that'd be a good idea. You know, we'll do that. And they add to it. Imagine if you had that pictograph. I mean, they did. It was called Egypt. It's just a more communication, a more accumulation of knowledge that you have, like the libraries of Alexandria when they burned down, man, I was like, oh, that was bad. You know, algebra and all this other stuff, you know, this is all invented by the Arabs. You know, the Arab community, they had an enormous wealth of information. Well, a lot of that went up in smoke. But anytime you have that accumulation of knowledge, you have great changes. The internet's going to have great changes. Information is now available to almost anybody on the planet. I mean, I don't care if you're a poor Congo, African, whatever. They got a $100 winded-up powered laptop satellite, you boom, done. And I'm going, you know, this is what's happening. I don't know what they think is they're doing, you know, for these young minds, that they're trying to bring them into the system to be controlled or get them conditioned or whatever. But you tap a young mind into the knowledge of the planet, I don't care where you are, you know, stuff happens. In fact, they did a story, one of the TED Talks that they did. There was a young man that saw a windmill. He saw that windmills made power, and he wanted to, you know, get a light bulb for his mom in his African hut. He wanted to be able to have power to do, like, you know, electricity. So he went and at a scrap and scrap wire and scrap wood and scrap. He went and saw a book that he couldn't even read. He just saw the diagrams, built a electrical generating windmill for his village. Just did it. He saw pictures that were in the missionaries that were there, brought some books and everything, and he saw this windmill thing, and he built it. And he spoke enough English, you know, from the missionary schools and everything. He was able to give a presentation. We had it on Freedom's Feet. It was fascinating. Just, you know, just built it. You know, finding scrap somewhere, old, broken down, want to get some wire and everything. A village in Africa. This is what I'm talking about. You don't know where the next, oh my goodness, zero-point energy run neighborhood from a little dishwasher-sized thing, you know, started with a 13-year-old that took his grandmother's ionic breeze in a toaster, and all of a sudden, boom, there it is. You know, there's not a doubt in my mind that that's exactly what's going to happen. Never was. You know, I encouraged my children to be able to think this way. The answer is always yes. It's just how much effort's got to go into it. Well, the accumulation of this information and the ability and the desire to share it has been going on for generations. And there's been a link from the generation before me and me taking this up. And I'm going to, you know, take the rest of the show and try and, you know, weave it together for you so you understand how it happened. I'll be right back.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence of me, Ernest Hancock. And I always considered myself one of the youngins. I mean, you start getting close to 50. I mean, you know, next March I'll be 50, and, you know, young's not a word that comes to mind. You know, but, you know, our society is getting so much older that 50's not, in comparison, relative, it's not that old anymore. I'm in, like, the mids, you know. I'm certainly middle age, I would imagine. But there's a lot of history that, you know, when I first started doing this, you know, 20-something years ago, so somebody that I met that was in, you know, their 50s then, or in their 70s now. You know, time whizzes by, man. Boom. Well, I want to go back to the beginning. Harry Everingham, the founder and head director, guy in charge of the Arizona Breakfast Club, that came about after he had already a decade's career in freedom fighting. And when he retired to Arizona in the late 60s, he started the Arizona Breakfast Club. What happened is you had all these winter visitors back when, you know, people, you know, could retire. And they would go, where are we going? We're going to Sun City. Yep, we're going to go to Sun City. We're going to Arizona I-8. So they came to Arizona, and they either retired here year-round or they would spend part of the year and then leave in the summer. So the Breakfast Club originally was every Saturday, but it was from September, mid-September, I think, to May. And then it took off May, June, July, August. So it was like 4 months it took off. So it's on 8 months, off four. Well, everybody, I mean, it came. I've been in the early 90s. It was a woohoo, how you been? What is the first Breakfast Club of the season? Man, power to people and whatever. And from around the country, they'd come and tell their stories, what's going on. Different. That was extremely interesting, just that. They, you know, where they were back in Indiana and Minnesota and New York and Quebec and wherever, you just, you know, what was going on, the expansion of the empire that way. Because you come back and you hear all these stories that, you know, they're doing the same thing at the same time in small communities across Northern America. So I'm going, okay, this is good news to have. I mean, it's not good news, but it's, you know, it's good to know it. So I was very interested in the history. I was smart enough to know that I wasn't smart enough to know. So what I did is I always grilled these guys. Some of these guys there, a lot of them were military. A lot of them were fighter pilots. They were in World War II. They, you know, some in Vietnam, Korea, that kind of stuff. A lot of them. And one guy, I had him have my son sit down, and just after one of the meetings, we just sat down. And I go, tell us everything. I just sit down. You're going to hear this. And it went on for at least a half hour or so. He was one of the original Flying Tigers in China. There were, I guess you'd call them mercenaries or whatever, American fighter pilots that were based in China as the Japanese were invading China and so on. They're out there doing battle with P-40s against Japanese Zeros. You know, and they did, you know, John Wayne movie about it and all that kind of stuff. Well, here's one of the guys that was actually one of the pilots. Oh, do you think we take advantage of that one? Yeah, absolutely. So this is the generation of people that I hung out with in my early 30s, late 20s, early 30s. I'm associating with these people, getting all of their information, but they had a particular perspective. This is before I, you know, even knew the word libertarian. So I wouldn't join groups. I just didn't feel comfortable in any organization. There was 15 gazillion organizations. I mean, oh yeah, we need some. Yeah, come on, new blood. Yeah, let's go. And you know, I get a shiny badge, and I just don't want to play because I didn't really have a full beat understanding what was going on. I just knew that they were just repeating the bullet point that was coming from the right. But I like the people. I mean, you know, we get along fine. And how I got to know the Breakfast Club, I was asked to be a speaker one time and about my lawsuits and, you know, what I was doing and so on. And I came in and spoke to them, and they really were genuinely interested. And they asked a lot of questions, and they understood my perspective. They just hadn't seen it in a long time because they always had politicians that would come there. I mean, even Janet Napolitano had to go touch the ring, okay? You go, when she's running for governor back in 02, yep, got to go to Breakfast Club. I mean, you know, you got, man, you got to serve your time. Arpaio's there all the time. Russell Pierce been there many times. You know, all these politicians, they used to be, that was the Breakfast Club. It was always debates and so on with all these politicians and such. And then it just started getting harder for them. They got harder. It wasn't just they got to go and give a presentation. They had to go and face the gauntlet because the people started understanding, knowing what was going on. By the mid-90s, and the internet starting to go, just even in the 94 election to 98 election cycles there, those three election cycles, 94, 96, 98, the libertarians, we understood. We could use the internet, the email list, and make sure that we all had information of what was going on everywhere. And then the people that came from those small communities, we were telling before they even went back, well, watch out for this. They're doing this regional government thing out at the county level. It was a new level they wanted to create, an entire new level of government that was linked to the federal government using the counties. And they have not forgot about this. This is going to come back if they haven't already done it in the name of something else. You know, as part of this multi-jurisdictional task force, you know, with the federal marshal kind of designation you give to local police departments and the counties and all that kind of stuff. And Arpaio was first in line for that. So you have Phoenix policemen that are federal marshals deputized that go with M16 machine guns at the Sky Harbor National Airport now. That's all part of this. We saw it coming a long time ago, and we screamed about it and made every, you know, it's just, hey, FYI, we just want to make sure. You know, and when this comes, oh, you're just conspiratorial crazy. Yeah, huh? You say that now until it happens. And then you'll say, oh, well, yeah, it's good. You know, 9/11. I go, yeah, yeah. Well, what happens when they do this and this and this and this and this? And then it just keeps, so finally, they're, you know, as time goes on, I go, I don't know. Next time those libertarian guys say something, I'm like, you know, maybe I might listen just a little bit. Well, a lot of the stuff, you know, was coming from people like John Birch Society. John Birch Society, man, they were way more right more often than just about anybody else on this stuff, but they're starting to be infiltrated too. Because when you have that kind of respect, when you have that ability to share this kind of information with people and they'll listen to it, what happens? Well, somebody's got to get in control of that. They want to make sure that, you know, they get the right spin on it, or they don't say certain things, or they make sure they focus on other things that aren't important, like the immigration thing. John Birch Society, this is it. You know, immigration is it. This is what's coming, because that's the battle. They're trying to really get the John Birch Society. It's not the welfare state and the warfare state and all this conspiracy. It's not them anymore. It's these illegal immigrants, you know, that are coming across. They're the problem. And I'm like, wow. We'll see how that works. Hopefully that won't go as easy as they think, because that kind of stuff's been tried before with them. So I'm going, okay, so now I'm interested in who these people were, because I recognized a lot of them as me and my friends and my family. I go, you know, Harry, yeah, he may be 70-whatever years old when I first met him, but, you know, late 70s, and he and his wife, and she would play the piano, you know, and kind of get everybody working. We'd sing. We still sing at the breakfast. God sang. It's a good time to get acquainted. It's a good time to know. I mean, you know, who is sitting beside you and all that kind of stuff. And then it's like, let's see, chow. We all want chow. That's what we're here for now. I mean, you know, we do this every out of tradition, out of respect for the traditions of the Breakfast Club. Yeah, sing for your breakfast. And new people that come or speaker, they're like, what the heck was that? Because we sing really bad anyway. But so I wanted to know who these people were. And I talked to them and asked them, and this was the story. Harry Everingham was part of a motivational crew that, and I don't know if he got paid or his volunteer or built his list, or I'm not really sure, but he was definitely, you know, Patriot America, MK, he was America guy. He would go to these large factories that were building tanks and airplanes and all that kind of stuff, and they would show them the captured Nazi U-boat films. You know, when they get them, they have all these propaganda films. Yes, you know, a steel deal, slap, clonk, 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 clonk. You know, all this patriotic stuff for the Nazis. And they would show it and say, look, this is what they're being programmed with. This is what they want to do. This is their stated goal. This is the subtitle of what they're saying. This is they're going to, you know, take over the planet. We have to stop fascism or blah, 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 blah. Okay. So he would get people all worked up, and they were quick to join. Yeah, we the people, United we stand. These are the organizations that he had. And they signed up, and there were tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands. I mean, it's just, you know, a big woo-hoo thing. Well, of course, it served the interest of the government, because he was out there motivating the people to be more productive, you know, to be more careful, to be more accurate in their, you know, milling, to make sure that the shells were done correctly, to make sure that the women knew they were appreciated for a Rosie Riveter kind of campaign stuff. This is where he came from. Then it's end of World War II. Then what's the new enemy? It's communism. Go from fascism to communism. There, you know, these are the kind of guys that were cheering McCarthy on. They're like, oh, heck yeah, get rid of the communist. Hollywood full of communist. And a lot of people don't know the history. That's where Ronald Reagan came from. Ronald Reagan was an actor. You know, he was, you know, he's a big patriot. I don't think he, you know, the only uniform he wore was in some, you know, pro-World War II American movie, you know, or something. But, I mean, I didn't try and, you know, lie about it or anything. He's like, yeah, my war effort was to encourage people to be patriotic, you know, this nationalistic fervor, to, you know, buy war bonds, you know, that kind of thing. So that was his role. He became president of the Screen Actors Guild. This is, you know, the actor union or whatever. So he's president of the Screen Actors Guild, and during that time, it was during this McCarthy anti-communist thing that was going on, there was a big deal about the communists were taking over Hollywood. All of these communists, all of these communist Jews, all of this, you know, whatever, they're in Hollywood. They are trying to change our culture. Okay? It always comes down to that. It changing us. Well, they knew this from Nazi propaganda films. They're doing the same thing in Russia. You know, it's all about this new medium of visual that you could put somebody and blare the speakers and put them in a room and show them some images and the big giant rallies in color that, whether you're coronating a king, you know, or queen of England, or you're doing, the prime minister or chancellor of give me all the power kind of Stalin, you know, Roosevelt, whatever. I mean, this is powerful propaganda tool. There is a thing. You go on Freedom's Phoenix. You know, I want to tell you about this in this show. You can just go, and it'll probably be up there even in the archives in the future. I always have this up there. You go to freedomsphoenix.com. At the top navigation bar, you'll see where it says special editions. You know, it says letters to the editor, sign up for the newsletter, be a reporter, link to us, blah, blah, special editions. You hover over special editions. And it has a drop down, and the fourth one down says Ernie's Favorites. What this is we have special editions. You know, you have the global edition is what freedomsphoenix.com is, but there's other editions. It works the same way. It looks kind of the same. Some of them are a little bit different. Some use different color schemes or logos or whatever, but it provides the same ability to create headlines that put them in on a page. I just get to have my own because I like having stuff that I can reference for like the show here or send to people or send they want to know what my focus is and whatever. Because Freedom's Phoenix, that's everybody's. You know, go whatever. But you want to know what my say is? You go to Ernie's Favorites. That's me. Okay. So I go in there and you'll see at the top, I put it up at the top. It's called The Century of the South. And it was a series done by the BBC. And it's a four-part series, and there was another one done, too. It was called The Power of Nightmares and how they scare you into doing all this stuff, 9/11 kind of thing. It was very, very, very interesting. And The Century of the Self was just as interesting in giving the history on where all this crap came from. You know, it's just it's phenomenal to me that there was a concentrated effort to brainwash us. It wasn't a secret. You know, this wasn't like made up. It wasn't like they didn't know, you know. So I'm going, okay, so how do we learn from this? Okay. Well, what we're going to do is I'm going to play you a little bit of the beginning of that intro into that series because it really kind of explains it. We'll just do a couple of minutes here, and let me get this, and we'll go ahead and play this. Because what it does is it just gives you how they used modern marketing techniques and propaganda, which was known. I mean, it wasn't a big giant secret. You know, they had this was tools that they used in, you know, not said Germany. And to think that we weren't going to, you know, have it done to us is just, you know, be naive. You know, and this was part of what Harry was doing, you know, in service of his country, he thought, you know, but these were the techniques. Go ahead and give this a listen. I get to play. Now I'll set it up during the break, and we'll do it when we come back. Because it's interesting in looking at what Freud had learned is that we all act emotionally. You know, we react to the stimulus out there, and we get knee-jerk reactions that can be predicted over and over and over and over. And even somebody that do logic and reason, you know, like the Spock character in 1968, 67, they come up on Star Trek. It's all logic and reason. You know, where did that character come? Where that was kind of derived from this objectivist stuff of Ayn Rand, this libertarian thing that was going on. They were using the word libertarian, you know, decades before the Libertarian Party. The Libertarian Party was like a side effect of the philosophy. It wasn't the other way around. So what they did is you have this philosophy of just logic and reason. Well, even she would say, look, I mean, you know, emotion has a role. I mean, it's a shortcut when you need it. It's a reflex. And she explained it like this. It's like you're in a dark parking lot and somebody comes out, boo! I mean, I'm gonna rob you, rape you, whatever you know, and you don't act with reason. You act with emotion. You know what I mean? You have an impact, a fear impact, and that can be used. That condition can be constantly tapped into. unless you're aware of it. How do you defend against this kind of stuff? I got plenty for you. You stay right there. We'll be right back.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
New theory about human nature was put forward by Sigmund Freud. He had discovered, he said, primitive sexual and aggressive forces hidden deep inside the minds of all human beings. Forces which, if not controlled, led individuals and societies to chaos and destruction. This series is about how those in power have used Freud's theories to try and control the dangerous crowd in an age of mass democracy. At the heart of the story is not just Sigmund Freud, but other members of the Freud family. This episode is about Freud's American nephew, Edward Bernays. Bernays is almost completely unknown today, but his influence on the 20th century was nearly as great as his uncle's. Because Bernays was the first person to take Freud's ideas about human beings and use them to manipulate the masses. He showed American corporations for the first time how they could make people want things they didn't need by linking mass-produced goods to their unconscious desires. Out of this would come a new political idea of how to control the masses. By satisfying people's inner selfish desires, one made them happy and thus docile. It was the start of the all-consuming self, which has come to dominate our world today.
The Century of the Self. It's a fascinating series, and it goes up until you get to the point of, Margaret Thatcher and Reagan era in the early 80s. And what they had discovered by then, was that, you know, the masses are easy to manipulate, and because you're really going for an average, you're going for, you know, vote totals, you're going for marketing decisions, you're going for, you know, the certain personalities that you can get to do things, and then those that don't, you know, how can you convince them and still keep these other guys or use them to do it? So then they started doing these questionnaires, and I remember them talking about I think it was in England they did it, or US, I think it was England. And they send out these extensive questionnaires. I mean, sometimes you've done these personality questionnaires and you just, oh, man, you're asking the same thing five gazillion times. I mean, you know, I get it. And there's a reason why, and it's a psychological thing. And what they did is they sent out – it was a bunch of questions. I mean, hundreds or something. I mean, it was some ridiculous amount of thick stack of paper. But they got 70, 80% of them back. It was amazing. They're like, what the heck? It's because nobody had ever asked these questions before. Nobody had ever really, and it was entertaining. They never even thought before. They weren't thinking. They've been just dumbed down by television and whatever that I don't know, I never thought of that before. So they were filling these out. They were happy to. This is back before people knew better. And they're just like, hey, bring on the census taker, man. So they were filling out all of this data for this marketing company, and they gave it to him. And this is where your A personality stuff came out. You know, the A-type personality, your B-type personality. You know, the kind of the people that go and do and get and buy and all that kind of stuff. This is where this came from. What they found out is that there's a smaller percentage of the population, your A-types, they're the ones that get things done. Yes, whatever the mental hurdle that's in a lot of people's heads that keep them from doing stuff or trying new things or getting, you know, involved in or leading people to whatever, you know, that's not there. It's not them. They just do. Well, if you can get the A-type people to do this or to the B-type people to perceive that an A person is doing it, then they'll buy it. They'll get it. That's where celebrity endorsements came from. So this is it. We are being programmed as a mass. We'll talk about it when we come back.